Section 2, Nationalism, Sectionalism, and States' Rights. As you read, look for the contrast between the rise in nationalism and the rise in sectionalism. Different economic interests of the Northeast, the old Northwest Territory, and the South. The importance of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The rise in anti-slavery sentiment and in states' rights. The nullification crisis and the Great Reaction. Terms: nationalism, internal improvements, sectionalism, protective tariff, Missouri Compromise, abolitionist, nullify, secession. The story of South Carolina in the antebellum era plays an important part in the story of America in the same period. Early in the era, the state expressed a strong sense of national unity and patriotism. However, by 1830, South Carolina politicians and voters had decided that the federal government had turned against them. How does a state challenge the authority and power of the central government? That question dominated much of American history in the antebellum era. The Era of National Enthusiasm in South Carolina, 1790 to 1825. Nationalism is the sense of pride in one's country, its people, its institutions, and government. It is the patriotic glue that holds people in a nation together. Often, that nationalism is most noticeable when a country is threatened by enemy nations. American nationalism was born in resistance to Great Britain during the American Revolution. In its first 25 years under the new Constitution, 1789 to 1814, Americans were brought closer together by violations of the rights of American ships by both Great Britain and France. The United States avoided war until the British began stopping our ships, seizing cargo, and forcing some of our sailors into the British Navy. In 1812, the Congress declared war on Great Britain in the conflict known as the War of 1812. Four of the strongest advocates for war in the Congress were John C. Calhoun, Langdon Chevre, William Lowndes, and David R. Williams. These South Carolinians were among a group of young congressmen called War Hawks. Nationalism at its best inspires unity and helps a diverse people accomplish great things. At its worst, it insists on fighting every nation with which there is a quarrel. The war was a near disaster for the young United States. In 1814, British troops captured Washington, D.C., and burned the White House and other public buildings. The war was basically a draw, and a treaty was signed in December 1814 with nothing really accomplished for either side. But the biggest battle of the war was fought in January 1815, before news of the treaty arrived in America. In that Battle of New Orleans, General Andrew Jackson and a ragtag American force, aided by a few pirates, defeated a large, well-trained British army. This victory gave Americans the feeling they had won the war that some called the Second War of American Independence. We would not be pushed around. We were truly independent now. Americans rode high on the wave of national pride for the next decade. The overwhelming election of James Monroe, a Democratic Republican from Virginia, in 1816, ushered in an era of good feelings. After the 1816 election, the Federalist Party died, leaving only one organized political party, the Democratic Republicans. John C. Calhoun, the major South Carolina political leader of the 19th century, was at first a part of this sense of national unity. He wanted to strengthen the nation with internal improvements, government projects to improve transportation and trade. These included building roads, bridges, and canals, and improving harbors. A tariff on imports provided the money. Calhoun also wanted to charter a new United States bank to help stabilize the currency, money, system, and improve the economy. Calhoun supported all these national projects in Congress as President Monroe's Secretary of War and finally as Vice President under President John Quincy Adams from 1825 to 1829. Rising sectional sentiment. Sectionalism is allegiance to one region of the country as opposed to loyalty to the broader interest of the whole country. By the 1820s, the United States had developed into three rather distinct sections with different economic interests. In the Northeast, farming was still important, but towns and cities based on industry were becoming even more important. That section wanted the federal government to promote industry, especially with a protective tariff. A protective tariff is a duty, tax, on imports that protects American manufactured goods from competition from cheaper goods made in other countries. All these states had abolished slavery within their borders and were becoming increasingly opposed to slavery elsewhere in the nation. The old Northwest Territory became the states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. This section became the breadbasket of the nation, producing an abundance of corn, wheat, and livestock. Many of its settlers were immigrants, and most were opposed to slavery. Congress had prohibited slavery in the Northwest Territory in 1787. The South was becoming more dedicated to producing cotton, though certain regions continued to produce rice, tobacco, or sugarcane. These staple crops were dependent on slavery. The South had a much stronger sense of being unique than the Northeast or the Northwest. The Southern states became very defensive because the other two sections together had a much larger population and because the attacks on slavery became louder and more forceful. The 1820s was a decade of great change for South Carolina. Carolinians tended to blame the federal government, specifically the 1824 protective tariff, for their troubles. They argued that the tariff only helped the North and hurt the South. Southerners exported agricultural products and imported many necessities. The tariff forced them to pay higher prices for imported goods. The government was favoring the North and discriminating against the South, they felt, and they were also becoming more worried about national attitudes toward slavery. The Missouri Compromise of 1820. The issue of slavery was raised dramatically in 1819 when Missouri applied for admission to the Union. Northern opposition to slavery in the new state set off a furious debate over whether Congress had the authority to limit the spread of slavery. This question would eventually tear the nation apart. Congress settled the issue temporarily by adopting the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which allowed Maine into the Union as a free state and Missouri as a slave state. This kept the number of states, and thus the number of senators, balanced between free and slave states. This would prevent either section from overpowering the other. But another provision of the compromise ruled that all the northern territories of the Louisiana Purchase were to be free of slaves. Apparently, Congress did have the authority to limit the expansion of slavery. Southerners were not convinced. The Denmark-Vesey Plot. Whites in South Carolina lived in constant fear of slave uprisings. There had not been a real slave revolt since the Stono Rebellion of 1739, but rumors of plots were common. 5 slaves were executed for a conspiracy in Camden in 1816. In 1822, 2 slaves in Charleston revealed a plot by Denmark Vesey, a former slave who had bought his freedom with money won in a lottery. He was a skilled carpenter and taught Bible lessons at night at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal AME Church. Dozens of slaves and free blacks were arrested. Vesey and 34 others were hanged, 37 were deported, and 23 were acquitted, found not guilty. Slaveholders across the South were frightened and angry. Much of the anger in South Carolina was directed toward the free blacks in their midst. Whites burned Emmanuel AME Church. Charleston organized a municipal guard of 150 men to control free blacks. The General Assembly passed an act of revenge against all free black seamen on ships coming into Charleston. They were to be locked in the city jail and only released when their ship was ready to depart. The captain had to pay for their room and board, or they could be sold as slaves. As might be expected, fewer ships visited Charleston. White Carolinians closing their minds. The white people of the state began to close their minds to any ideas from outside that were contrary to their notions of white superiority. The military began to take an even greater place of honor in society. Writers made virtual saints of Sumter, Marion, Pickens, the Pinckneys, and George Washington. The leaders created the Citadel, first in 1822 as a guardhouse and arsenal, then in 1842 as the South Carolina Military Academy. South Carolina was alarmed in 1831 by news of the Nat Turner Rebellion in Virginia. Turner led a small band of slaves in a revolt they hoped would sweep across the South. Before the revolt was crushed, 55 whites and as many slaves had died. The Turner Rebellion reconfirmed Southern whites' fear of the slaves in their midst. It also made them more certain that abolitionists, people who wanted to do away with slavery from the North, were stirring up trouble with their propaganda. The rising tide of anti-slavery sentiment in the country. Opposition to slavery had always existed in America, even in the South. By the end of the 1820s, though, almost all opponents had been driven out of the South or silenced. The most famous exiles from South Carolina were Sarah and Angelina Grimke, daughters of a prominent Charleston family. Instead of enjoying a life of privilege and plenty, they chose to leave the state and join the anti-slavery cause in the North. Both became prominent writers and speakers for abolition and women's rights. As angry as South Carolinians were with free blacks and rebellious slaves, they were even angrier with Northern anti-slavery advocates, who grew more numerous and aggressive each year. In the 1820s, 9 states passed resolutions in favor of the gradual freeing of slaves in the United States. The American Colonization Society asked the federal government for money to purchase slaves and free them in a colony in Africa. Slaveholders were outraged. Most of the anti-slavery advocates before 1830 had aimed at the gradual freeing of slaves and compensation for the slave owners. After 1830, the emphasis of many anti-slavery advocates shifted to outright abolition of slavery, immediately and without pay for the owners. William Lloyd Garrison and former slave Frederick Douglass led the way along with the Grimke sisters. Abolitionists based their arguments on moral objections. Slavery was simply wrong and must be ended. Their cause was boosted by the abolition of slavery in the worldwide British Empire in 1833. The tide of history was turning against slavery. States' rights as a defensive strategy. Carolinians were feeling pushed into a corner in the 1820s and 1830s. The state's economy seemed on the slide, while the Northeast and Northwest were booming. The population of all the northern states was growing rapidly. Most immigrants preferred to settle in the North rather than compete with slave labor in the South, and agitation against slavery was increasing. These developments had political consequences. The North got a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, while slaveholding Southern states still had equal votes in the Senate. But the North had been able to pass a protective tariff in 1824, despite South Carolina's opposition. Then in 1828, the Congress passed an extremely high tariff that the South labeled the Tariff of Abominations. How could South Carolina protect its interest from the growing Northern majority? If the North could impose an abominable, horrible, detestable tariff, would it be long before that section could push through legislation against slavery? Even the nationalistic John C. Calhoun, who was vice president in 1828, became a defender of states' rights and proposed a way for South Carolina to protect itself against the majority in the nation. He wrote the South Carolina Exposition and Protest, which the General Assembly published without using Calhoun's name. In the exposition, Calhoun argued that a state could declare an act unconstitutional and nullify the law, that is, declare it invalid and of no effect within the state. He was wrestling with a central problem in a democracy. How can the rights of a minority be protected against violations by the majority? Carolinians thought it was urgent to find a method before the North started interfering with slavery in the South. South Carolina leaders like Robert Barnwell Rhett advocated secession, dissolving the state's connection to the nation and becoming a separate nation, with or without the company of other Southern states. Calhoun might have been willing to consider secession as a last resort, but it seems clear he was using nullification to develop a way to work within the Union. Rhett saw nullification as a step toward secession. The nullification crisis. What happened next was high drama in national politics. One scene in the drama took place in the U.S. Senate in 1830, in one of the most famous debates in Senate history. Robert Y. Hayne of South Carolina, an ally of Calhoun, took on Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, the Senate's most famous orator. The Hayne-Webster debate was a series of speeches over 9 days. Hayne supported nullification and declared that the Southern states would never tolerate, quote, any interference whatever in their domestic concerns, end quote. Webster asserted the strong nationalist position that we could only have liberty within the Union, finishing his argument with a flourish, quote, liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable, end quote. A second scene in the drama, a political struggle between nullifiers and unionists, took place across the map of South Carolina from 1830 to 1832. Nullifiers were in favor of nullification. They believed that the state could refuse to obey or enforce a federal law that the state thought was unconstitutional or violated its state's rights. Unionists believed that the state could best deal with political issues within the Union rather than in defiance of federal law. Governor James Hamilton, Jr. led the nullifiers in a well-organized drive to elect nullifiers, call a convention, and nullify the tariff. Calhoun added his support from Washington, where he was vice president, this time under Andrew Jackson. The Unionists, supported by small upcountry farmers, were led by James L. Pettigrew, Joel Poinsett, and William Drayton. The 2-year campaign produced a big win for the nullifiers in 1832. They called the Nullification Convention and declared null and void both the Tariff of 1828 and a new one passed in 1832. A confrontation like the young nation had never experienced before was set. The General Assembly elected Robert Y. Hayne governor, and he appointed outgoing Governor Hamilton to prepare the state militia to resist the federal government if necessary. Unionists also recruited volunteers to assist the U.S. Army if necessary. Once again, as in the American Revolution, South Carolinians were divided. The scene shifted back to Washington. Calhoun resigned as vice president in December 1832. He and President Jackson, both born in South Carolina, were at opposite poles on the issue of nullification. The General Assembly immediately elected Calhoun to the U.S. Senate to replace Hayne. Jackson's response to South Carolina's nullification was a very strong statement that nullification was unconstitutional. Secession he labeled as treason. He was determined to enforce the law in every state, and Congress passed a force act to reinforce Jackson's authority. The possibility of a bloody showdown between the federal government and South Carolina was diffused by a compromise in Congress worked out by Calhoun and Henry Clay of Kentucky. The tariff would be gradually reduced, and South Carolina would drop its nullification. South Carolina repealed its nullification of the tariff, but nullified the Force Act. President Jackson wisely ignored this meaningless act of defiance, and the crisis was over. South Carolina got tariff reduction, but failed to establish nullification as a means of protecting a state from federal authority. The drama could have ended in civil war. South Carolina would have stood alone because other southern states considered its action unwise. The drama ended with South Carolina in social chaos, divided and bitter with deep scars. The nullifiers continued to inflict wounds by insisting on conformity within the state. The Great Reaction. In the years after the nullification crisis, South Carolina leaders imposed what historians label the Great Reaction. The General Assembly enacted severe restrictions on Carolinians' freedom. The state censored the U.S. mail to prevent distribution of abolitionist literature. In one historian's judgment, quote, "The Great Reaction achieved the most thoroughgoing repression of free thought, free speech, and free press ever witnessed in an American community," end quote. It is ironic, an unexpected outcome, that leaders who tried to protect a minority from the majority in the nation felt comfortable crushing out minority views within their state. South Carolina leaders continued military preparation, strengthened the night slave patrols, and tightened the slave codes. They defended slavery as a positive good for both whites and blacks. These harsh measures brought more attention and sympathy to the anti-slavery cause in the North than abolitionists could have generated on their own. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, sectionalism, protective tariff, nullify. 2. What national offices did John C. Calhoun hold? 3. What causes did Sarah and Angelina Grimke support? 4.